This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. Each week in this podcast, I'll talk to some of the leading thinkers and researchers, entrepreneurs and executives about things like conscious capitalism, sustainability, and business ethics, things that feel all the more urgent as we as a planet face enormous challenges, climate change, pandemics, demands for social reform. Many of these challenges brought about, some would argue, by capitalism. Each episode, each guest will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. In our last episode, we tried to get a handle on how corporations engage in the political process. We talked about the three-pronged approach to corporate political engagement and even took a deep dive into the political complexion of my own portfolio. After that episode was released, I have to tell you about a conversation I had with my husband. First off, you have to understand something. We have four generations at my dinner table. My husband is a boomer, I'm a Gen Xer, and we have two daughters at home, one a millennial and one a Gen Y. All of this is to say that each of us comes to politics with a little bit different perspective. I can tell you that we all have a sense of social justice and our politics skew progressive, but my husband brought something to my attention, this dark money issue, and admonished me for not using the entire episode to talk about how the Citizens United decision was the poison pill that has become the death of our democracy. That may sound dramatic, but you have to keep in mind that my husband is a retired politician that worked in the 1960s civil rights movement. He's the one responsible for the nearly life-size portrait of Bobby Kennedy in our dining room and Pete Seeger on the family playlist. And it was my husband's passionate reaction that got me thinking more about that intersection that we talked about in our last episode, that intersection between politics and business. We should really talk about this, because here amidst the Black Lives Matter movement, what we might say is this generation's civil rights movement, and I got to thinking, how much do we really know about that other civil rights movement, the corporate civil rights movement? Well, 10 years into the Citizens United era, where corporations have an expanded political voice, let's put a pause on old Pete Seeger for a moment and update the playlist with a little Roy Zimmerman. If your hair's on fire, let's talk about it. The untold story of the corporate civil rights movement with UCLA corporate law historian Adam Winkler. Adam Winkler, welcome to the What Does It Profit podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, let's tell the audience that you are a UCLA law professor and author of one of my favorite history books, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. Thank you for writing the book.
Oh, well, thank you for having it be one of your favorite books. It's one of mine, too, in fact. It was actually a really fun book to write. It was inspired by the Supreme Court's controversial decision in Citizens United. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that corporations, business corporations, have the same right of free speech as you and me. And this caused a lot of hullabaloo with protesters saying, hey, corporations are not people. And I decided I wanted to look back at the history of this idea. How did corporations come to have the same rights as you and me? And it turns out the story is much, much older than Citizens United and goes back to America's very earliest days. And I wanted to tell that story in We the Corporations.
Well, it's very timely. I mean, we're at a time in history when the world seems to have this renewed focus on civil rights, particularly as we see the Black Lives Matter movement unfolding and the Me Too movement. Is really what you're saying? There's a business civil rights movement that's been going on behind the scenes, perhaps?
Yeah, indeed, there really has been. And it's not the kind of civil rights movement we're used to when we think about racial minorities or women, people organizing, grassroots organizing, parades in the streets, marches, and explicit claims for inclusion, right? With corporations, it's been a much more subtle process. You know, Ronald McDonald and the Jolly Green Giant don't march down Main Street with signs saying corporations are people too. Instead, corporations have fought their civil rights revolution in the Supreme Court. And in the same way that women and minorities gained important victories like Brown versus Board of Education, Supreme Court cases that read the Constitution to grant women and minorities a greater share of rights that they had previously been denied, same thing with corporations. Corporations have been going to the Supreme Court for more than 200 years, claiming that they're entitled to the same rights under the Constitution as ordinary individuals. And unlike women and minorities, who have historically not been very successful in the Supreme Court, at least until the mid-20th century, corporations have been winning in the Supreme Court since the early 1800s. And so there's a long history of corporations fighting in the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, to win cases extending fundamental rights to them.
Well, wasn't it, almost 30 years before African Americans gained status, and then yet another 30 before women? So corporations really came first.
Well, to put it in perspective, sort of the first Supreme Court case on the rights of African Americans under the Constitution, the notorious Dred Scott case, was decided in the late 1850s. The first Supreme Court case on the rights of women, a case called Bradwell versus Illinois, was decided in the 1870s. And in those cases, both the minorities and the women lost in the Supreme Court. By contrast, the very first Supreme Court case involving explicitly the question, are business corporations entitled to a particular right or protection under the Constitution? The first case was in 1809, a half century before the like cases for racial minorities and women. And unlike the racial minorities and women in their first cases, the corporation involved in that case, the Bank of the United States, at the time the richest and most powerful corporation in America, won its case. And corporations have been winning these cases in the Supreme Court really ever since.
Well, you know, let's dial this back to what may be arguably the foundation myth of the United States. I mean, we think of our country coming together around the exercise of religious liberty, fleeing the old world for the new. I think there's maybe another way to look at this story.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the things that I do tell the story of in my book is how, in many ways, America began as a corporation. You know, one of the stories we tell ourselves is that America was born in freedom with the pilgrims escaping the tyranny of the monarchy and going and establishing their bulkhead up in Plymouth. And that tells a story that very much reminds us of the American ethos of democracy, of civil rights, of the fight against tyranny and democracy. But we often forget that the first colony was actually down in Jamestown, not in Plymouth. And Jamestown was undoubtedly a corporate affair, basically a trading post by, at the time, one of England's first stock corporations, the Virginia Company of London, that formed a trading corporation to go out and exploit the resources of the New World. So before the pilgrims even come, the business corporation has established a beachhead on American soil. And indeed, one of the things I find in my book and tell the story about is that there's even many provisions of the Constitution itself that really stem from our history as original corporate colonies. Many of the original colonies were formed as business corporations, and they, of course, transformed over time into political governments, but they shared many of the same principles, including the very idea of a written constitution. Corporations had written charters, and so did the corporate colonies of the early republic.
Well, you mentioned when we first started our conversation this case, Citizens United, and this idea that corporations being viewed as people and the Pillsbury Doughboy and Jolly Green Giant and Ronald McDonald walking down the street. I have all these images floating in my mind, but where does this concept of a corporate personhood come from? I mean, it's much older.
Well, that's right. I mean, as much as it's been controversial in recent years, it's actually a very long and established principle of business law. that corporations are people. In fact, there's a very, very influential legal treatise written by a guy named William Blackstone, very influential among the founders. It was his treatise came out before the revolution. And he has a discussion about how the law treats corporations, and he calls them artificial persons. And that's the idea. And it's still a sort of key principle of business law today, which is that a corporation is its own legally recognized entity, and that the rights and responsibilities, the debts that it has, the responsibilities that it has in that way are owned by the corporation and not by the people who form the corporation, the members or the employees. That's why we have something like limited liability. If you slip and fall at Starbucks tomorrow, you can't sue the shareholders of Starbucks. You sue Starbucks, the corporation. And Starbucks, the corporation, is the one who's responsible for paying any damages that you might suffer. That's an idea of corporate personhood. A corporation has its own legal standing in the eyes of the law. It's become more controversial in recent years as the court has used that principle or similar principles to expand the rights of business corporations so that now not only are corporations legal entities and recognized to be legally independent entities, but now they even have some of the most fundamental constitutional rights that you and I have.
Well, the one I like the most, I guess, came to us via the New York Times, you know, the right of free speech of corporations. We think about people having the right to free speech, but I guess maybe it wasn't a given that so does the media.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the stories I tell in my book is that long before Citizens United, all the way back in the 1930s, we had one of the very first Supreme Court cases to strike down a law for violating the freedom of speech. And this case was brought by a business corporation. It came out of Louisiana. Huey Long was the demagogue who was the governor and then senator from Louisiana, who really ran that state with an iron fist. And when the major media outlets in Louisiana opposed his political program, Huey Long tried to censor them. He accused them of publishing fake news and imposed a tax on the major newspapers of Louisiana. Those newspapers challenged that tax as a violation of their freedom of speech and freedom of the press under the First Amendment. And despite the fact that they were business corporations claiming these rights, the Supreme Court said, yes, the First Amendment protects against this kind of effort by government censorship. And protects newspapers, even though newspapers are formed as corporations and do enjoy. So ever since the 1930s, they have enjoyed free speech rights, at least the limited free speech rights that are associated with freedom of the press.
Well, one of the other cases that's come out recently that some of our listeners may be somewhat familiar with is the Hobby Lobby case and this idea of perhaps religious rights of corporations. How does that work?
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the most controversial cases in recent years on this question of the constitutional rights of corporations is Hobby Lobby and its sister case, Masterpiece Cake Shop. And actually, Hobby Lobby arose under a federal statute, but the principles were the same. And the question about whether a corporation could assert a religious liberty interest to refuse to follow a law that would otherwise bind them. And in this case, it was a law that required large employers to provide birth control for their employees. And Hobby Lobby decided it didn't want to comply with that and argued that it had a religious right not to provide that kind of birth control. And the Supreme Court said that indeed, Hobby Lobby did have that religious right under a federal statute. And then a couple years later said that a cake shop that didn't want to provide a wedding cake for a same-sex couple also had a First Amendment right of religious freedom and could challenge the requirement that they provide a wedding cake regardless of the sexual orientation of the purchasers. And here what we see is the ability of business corporations to either make decisions about fundamental things like birth control for their employees, at least providing them access or denying them access when the law says that they have to provide that access, or in Masterpiece Cake Shop, a real important civil rights issue where people, corporations are basically gaining exemptions from civil rights laws that prohibit discrimination on unwanted bases.
Well, how does that work? It sounds like it's almost like you have to weigh the relative value of the rights of a corporation versus the rights of, like, say, in a civil rights or a human rights case, an actual living, breathing person.
Yeah, and in recent years, the corporations have been winning those cases, indeed. That's right. I mean, there's a lot of employees of Hobby Lobby that don't have access to birth control now, even though there's a federal law that requires healthcare companies to provide that birth control to them. And we see in the same-sex marriage context, which is, I think, one of the areas that's most prominent today of corporate constitutional rights. Do corporations that are run by people who oppose same-sex marriage have to provide services for same-sex couples? And so far, the courts are kind of ruling in favor of the businesses. Truth be told, this is a question that we have faced before, and the courts came to a different conclusion before. In the 1960s, business corporations threw up numerous challenges to the Civil Rights Act, the law that said that you can't discriminate in places of public accommodation or employment on the basis of race or sex. And business corporations challenged those laws and took them all the way to the Supreme Court, indeed. But the courts ruled consistently against them, saying corporations do not have the right to discriminate. Fortunately, I think we're seeing courts go the other way now, confronting the civil rights issue of sexual orientation and gender identity.
So do you think it has to do with, political or ideological complexion of the current Supreme Court?
Well, there's no doubt that the Supreme Court is guided by the judicial philosophy of its various members. One of the things I show in my book is that, we often think about Supreme Court justices as liberal or conservative. And that does tell us something about some major cases and major issues. However, one thing that I find when looking at this history of corporate constitutional rights is how few dissenting judges there really have been over the years. That while some of the recent cases have definitely spurred very vigorous dissenting opinions from justices who oppose the expansion of corporate rights, over the course of American history, the Supreme Court has been very business-friendly by and large. And whether it's Democrats or Republicans who appoint the judges, the justices on the Supreme Court tend to rule in favor of businesses and business corporations. And one way that you can see that is by looking at these constitutional rights cases over the years and seeing the remarkable success of corporations at almost every turn to win new and expansive rights under the Constitution, turning what we think of as a document that's designed to protect the most vulnerable minorities really into a document that works to protect business interests and sometimes the wealthy and most powerful corporations in America.
Do you think that has anything to do with where we came from? In the beginning of this conversation, we talked about the corporate origins of our country. Do you think that's where some of this philosophy is coming from?
Well, certainly, if we count it as an indirect influence, that certainly the history does follow along a somewhat path-dependent approach. I think it's really a story of how important capitalism is to the American experience, and that was reflected in that story of Jamestown and the founding of America by a business corporation. It's always been about making money in America. And that while we talk about civil liberties and protection of minorities and dissent and fundamental rights, and those are important elements of the American experience too, we're never far removed from capitalism. And the courts have tended to be conservative institutions, not in terms of Republican versus Democrat, but in terms of being unwilling to rock the status quo very much, and have often thought that laws that protect businesses are often in the best interests of America in the long run.
Why do you think a lot of people haven't heard this story? I grew up with this, nice myth, and, it wasn't until later in life when I had experiences out in the business world that I saw, how these things started to unfold. Why do you think that is?
Well, I imagine the reasons are somewhat complex, but one big difference is that, as much as we see among some opponents of Citizens United an argument that corporations should have no rights, and there's even a move to amend the Constitution to eliminate all rights for corporations, I think that's a mistake, and I think it gets to this question you ask about why we didn't really notice. I think corporations need some basic rights under the Constitution, and it makes sense for corporations to have them. So for instance, when we're talking about the expansion to corporations of basic property rights protections, saying, for instance, that the government can't take your property without paying just compensation, that seems pretty commonsensical, right? Government shouldn't be able to swoop in and decide they're going to take Google's campus up in Northern California and make it a public park without paying Google just compensation. And similarly, we think that when corporations won, for instance, some of the rights of criminal defendants under the Constitution, many of our constitutional provisions are about protecting the rights of criminal defendants, people being investigated or charged or punished for crimes. When corporations first began to be charged with crimes, it made sense to extend some of those protections to them, right? They have deserved due process. A government shouldn't be able to just put a corporation out of business on mere allegation. It must prove those allegations in a court of law. So I think when we're talking about some of those rights, it makes a lot of sense to think about corporations as having some protections. But when the court is now doing as it is now by extending fundamental rights like the right of political speech in Citizens United to influence elections, something that we think of as not for corporations, but for people. When the court is saying that corporations have religious freedom rights, even though you never see a corporation in the church, you never see a corporation in temple or a mosque, it strikes some people as somewhat absurd or maybe an overly extreme and exaggerated application of this basic idea that corporations need some constitutional rights.
Well, you know, one of the things that I find curious is this idea of rights. It seems like there's a counterbalancing concept of responsibility, you know, even if it's, you know, just moral responsibility. Is there any discussion about, you know, the other side of this argument? If, you know, this plethora of rights that corporations have given, you know, does this give rise to maybe an ethical argument that, you know, corporations should be responsible?
You know, it certainly does. And it's been a theme throughout American history in periods where there have been critics of the Supreme Court's decisions extending rights to corporations. Often the argument is made, well, we have to recognize responsibilities too. You know, the truth of the matter is when we talk about the Constitution, it's mostly about rights and not very much about responsibilities. And the truth is individuals have mostly rights, but not a lot of responsibilities either. And there's nothing in the law that requires an individual to be, you know, considerate of others or to be anything but selfish and secure. As long as they're not interfering explicitly with the rights or property of others, then, you know, you have a right to be irresponsible in some ways. We have some responsibility in the Constitution. You have juror service, for instance. It wouldn't really make sense to require corporations to serve on juries. But other than that, we don't have a lot of responsibilities under the Constitution. And in the corporate context, the real one of the difficulties is what counts as a corporate responsibility? Is it the responsibility of the corporation to serve just the shareholders, the investors, and to provide them with the biggest returns possible? Or is it part of the responsibility of a corporation to be concerned with the well-being of all sorts of different members of the community, from employees to creditors to communities in which they're sited or impacted or consumers? And those are big questions that have, you know, that have been part of the debate about the nature of corporations for a long time. The Supreme Court certainly has not resolved it in this corporate rights cases.
Well, do you see anything of that sort on the agenda in the future?
Well, if we're talking about corporate responsibilities, I do think that we are in a current period of time where we're seeing a broadening and expanding of what is thought to be the responsibilities of corporations. I talk about in my book about how back in the famous case of Ford versus the Dodge brothers, a case where the courts, a state court back in the early part of the 20th century, held that corporations have to be organized and managed to serve the ends of investors, shareholders, not necessarily the ends of employees or benefiting communities or other constituents of the corporation. And that's been a very, very influential decision that's really shaped 20th century corporate law and corporate norms. We're seeing that challenged a bit these days. The Business Roundtable recently came out with an announcement that they said that the purpose of the corporations is to serve more than the shareholders. It's to serve larger communities of interest. I do think that increasingly we're seeing businesses feel that they have to step up and take affirmative steps to accomplish public policy goals that government is not that interested in solving. So maybe we're seeing an expanding understanding of the nature of corporations and their purposes.
So are you bullish or bearish on the role of corporations in modern society?
Well, I guess the last few years have taught me to be fearful of the future rather than hopeful. So, you know, I think what we are going to see is more cases, corporate rights cases in the future. I don't think that they're going to be used for necessarily ends that I would personally prefer in all cases. For instance, I mentioned that we're seeing corporations assert corporate rights and religious freedom rights so that they don't have to serve same-sex couples. I think that's a mistake. I think the civil rights laws should take precedence over corporate rights claims on the basis of sexual orientation, the way it did. They did when it came to questions of the religious freedom rights of corporations to discriminate on the basis of race, which we don't allow. I think we're also going to see a lot more corporate rights cases in coming years where corporations use existing doctrine, like the doctrine of commercial speech, a doctrine that protects corporations and their advertisements from excessive regulation. I think we're going to see the court expand that First Amendment doctrine, and corporations' commercial speech rights are going to be expanded. So we certainly haven't seen the end of corporate rights cases, and corporate rights cases, by their nature, are inherently problematic, even if sometimes they are the right decision.
Well, tell us, why did you decide to write this book, and why now?
Well, I decided to write the book. As I mentioned, I was really inspired by the Citizens United case that really took an issue and put it on the table and brought a lot of public recognition to the controversy over whether corporations should have constitutional rights. It just so happens that about 10 to 15 years earlier than before Citizens United, I had written a few pieces and had been interested in the question of corporations and their First Amendment speech rights as it pertains to elections and the electoral process. So it had been an issue I had been interested in a long time, and I realized there were so many remarkable stories that needed to be told, that the civil rights movement of business corporations is one of the most successful yet least well-recognized civil rights movements in American history, and it was time to tell that story.
Well, corporate civil rights, I'm going to ask you the quintessential What Does It Profit podcast question. Civil rights for corporations, what does it profit?
I think it profits us in the following ways. I think that the founders of the Constitution recognized that one of the key impediments to individual liberty was excessive government overreach, that the government would come and take things away from you that they shouldn't be taking away from you. Your property, your fundamental, your freedom of conscience, your privacy, maybe your right to bear arms. There are some of these things that in the age of corporations, because the founders never imagined corporations, but they became important part of American life in the first decade of the American Republic in terms of the expansion of business corporations in our economy. And if they didn't have those rights, then I think a lot of the government tyranny that the founders worried about would not be protected against, would not be prevented by the Constitution. So I think it has good effects in that way. It secures our ability to invest in corporations that then help create employment and job opportunities and the products that a consumer economy really enjoys. But there are some consequences too, and I think we see that in cases like Hobby Lobby and Citizens United and Masterpiece Cake Shop, whether it's maybe the American people, their ability to exercise their own self-governance in democracy might be undermined if corporations that have so much more money can outspend us and essentially drown out other voices in the political process. And it's a loss to us, I think, if the civil rights of minorities, such as sexual orientation, minorities or people who have gender identity questions or gender identity issues, that they shouldn't be discriminated against. And unfortunately, I think that one of the losses that we're going to have in the coming years is that the court is likely to protect the rights of corporations in that space less than protecting the rights of real people who suffer discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity.
Well, Adam Winkler, I have got to, again, promote your book. I'll make sure there's a link to Amazon so our listeners can find it in the show notes. But I thank you for investing some time with us to share these important stories and to highlight some of the fundamentals that happen behind the scenes that we, as we're out working in the world, sometimes perhaps take for granted.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure to be on and to share these stories with your listeners.
This is What Does It Profit? Links to resources related to the issues we've discussed in this episode are in the show notes. Tell us what you think in a rating and review on your favorite podcast app. It really does help. More information about the show can be found at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. In our next episode, we're going to dig into the flip side of corporate rights and talk about corporate responsibilities. Yes, this is a little bit of a sticky wicket, but I think we can all agree, at least, that corporations shouldn't hurt people. Next episode, we're going to talk to Mary Inman, a renowned legal counsel to some of the most heroic whistleblowers.
A lot more people are being deterred in the workplace, just realizing that because whistleblowers could be anywhere in the organization, that they recognize that there is risk for them, and that when wrongdoing is taking place, it's probably in their interest to be one of the first to speak up.
In the meantime, let your friends know about the show. Quick sharing links can be found on our website. We would love to hear from you. Show ideas and comments are always welcome. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at WDIP Podcast. What Does It Profit Podcast is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. The show is produced by Jordan Gaspour. Executive producers are Nate Toby and Barbara Landis. Special thanks to our talented interns, Nate, Niels, Hannah, and Andrew, and our friends at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business, Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, Business for Impact, the Beck Center for Social Impact and Innovation, the DC Chapter of Conscious Capitalism, and Switchin' Board Studios. And a special shout out to our friends at CastBox for adding us to their staff favorites list. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?